more thinking about learning, or the examined life?
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Obviously a reference to Socrates' statement that the unexamined life is not worth living. And this is, you know, sort of a bi-directional implication. We want to examine higher education. I want to talk about the higher education world for some specific reasons that we will engage today. But also, the whole point of this is to say why higher education can serve such a foundational role in providing that examination that we need of our lives, just like we need of our society and of our churches and of our denominations and so on. Obviously, I have a pretty high view of higher education. So I'm the president of a college, so it makes sense that I would have a high view of education and higher education in particular. But what we had done already, and I won't go back and rehash, was talk about the basic values that we normally associate with higher education, and then the just persistent doubts that exist about higher education. They're always around. And so we already hashed that out. I'm not gonna redo that today. But what I do want to start with today is why I'm having the discussion right now, why I'm raising the topic, because there are certain pressures against higher education right now that seem to be coming to a head. The culmination of all of these pressures has sort of pushed this topic out of me. So here are a couple of what I think are primary evidences of how this cynicism regarding higher education is emerging right now. So, you know, if nothing else, just think of them as examples. They're certainly not the whole list of things. In fact, this morning, as I'm recording this, not as you're listening to it, but this morning as I'm recording this, I heard another pushback against higher education, not even a terrible one, not a bad one, but just another indication that no matter what you're doing in higher education right now, someone's going to push back against it in one way or another. And this one was in the UT system every year. It's not UT. It's every college everywhere, every year, reevaluates their fees, their, you know, just the regular charges you have to make aside from reevaluating tuition and all that kind of stuff. And they had gone through the process of adopting some new fee rates and so on for, you know, whatever, I don't know, student service fees or book fees or lab fees or I don't know, whatever they were. And so, well, we're going to have a few new fees that we have to charge. Nope, there's a signature right away, the governor's action. You may not increase fees without, in fact, we're putting a freeze on fee increases and so on. And I understand that, too, because there is a desire to appeal to the public and say, I'm your advocate against that evil higher education. But also, there is a reason to say we need you to justify why you're going to increase those fees and not just do it because you want a nicer car for your provost. So I understand that people want to hold every organization accountable that depends on them for income. And certainly state higher education depends on tax money. So it's reasonable to do that. I get it. But the fact that you can't take a step to the left or the right without someone raising their head and saying, no, get back on the path. Do not take any steps right now. We do not trust you, higher education. It's almost absurd right now, the level that cynicism has taken. or has arrived at. So here are a couple of examples that I wanted to give you just so you're aware of it. And you may have heard of one or two of these, but may not know the details. So I thought I would share a little of that with you. I mean, one of the problems, and I won't give much detail to this one, I'll just skip through it. But one of the problems is that there are changes in current policy, or at least in current sentiment or temperament, regarding some of the pillars of higher education. And I'll take three of those pillars of higher education, so to speak. Freedom of speech on campus is one of the big deals about higher education. Intellectual freedom in the classroom, obviously one. Independence in the boardroom, that colleges are not run simply for political purposes or something like that. There needs to be an independence in higher education for it to be legitimate. Those are three, you know, pretty important. I will refer to them as pillars. They're not the only ones. We could find others and you could redivide those into different categories, whatever. But I'm going to talk about them as those three pillars. Freedom of speech on campus. Let's talk about this one. So I'm not lamenting here reasonable actions to prevent student protests from becoming violent or threatening of, you know, campus administrations. I'm a college president, for crying out loud. I think it's okay to keep administrators safe. Nor am I acting in a way that would, you know, or responding in a way that would say, oh, well, it doesn't matter if they're intruding on the rights of others. Obviously, you need to, you know, prevent protests from becoming violent, prevent students from becoming threatening towards administrators or faculty members or each other, and prevent them from intruding on the rights of others. That's a given. And it's in the law and regulations. Every campus would do that already to the extent that they can. However, if students are harassing Jewish students, for instance, because of Israel's actions in Gaza, after Hamas's actions in Israel, then obviously those students need to be disciplined or expelled. This is not a difficult concept. And I don't know of anyone who wouldn't agree with this. When students intrude on other students' rights, it's not hard to say, you have to stop that. We have to do something to take care of this. So I'm not talking about that. But students protesting Israel's actions, whether right or wrong, about the extent of their claims or in their understanding of the reality there, should not be disciplined simply because their political views were or might be offensive. And a lot of them are very offensive. But that's different than intruding on someone else's rights. And protecting that free speech is important. And some of that has been threatened over the last several months, or actually years, since October 7th. And again, I understand why. It's a touchy subject, and it's a very difficult subject to find the right balance on. But the idea of freedom of speech by itself, just for what it is, as what it is, freedom of speech qua freedom of speech, is an imperative for higher education to move forward and have the respectful position it ought to have. Anyway, with that said, that is being challenged in some way. And again, it's not just being challenged by regulators or by state governments or by, you know, legislators. It's also being challenged by people who are on campus. We're not going to allow this person to speak on this campus. We're going to protest and act in violent ways to prevent them from speaking. Even that is an indication that we've lost some grounding on how important free speech is on the campus. Of course, free speech is important everywhere, but on campuses, we can protect it in ways that we often don't try to do in the rest of society. And so we can sort of lead the way if we're doing it correctly. Let me give you a more poignant example, in my opinion, on the second pillar that I mentioned, intellectual freedom in the classroom. I think anybody can understand sort of commonsensically that if you don't preserve intellectual freedom in the classroom, then what you are inevitably inviting is a myopic classroom, one in which you can only say certain things and you can only teach certain ways and you can only include certain content. And it's just going to become shallower and shallower until we're all just saying the same things. And that's just not a good place to be for higher education, especially. So intellectual freedom, sort of a pillar of higher education's values. So here's the example, and you may not know this name. In the educational world, everybody knows this name now. Martin Peterson from Texas A&M. He's originally from Texas A&M. He's not there anymore. I'd say originally. He was a professor there over the last few years, and he teaches philosophy there and was instructed by the administration at Texas A&M. I'm not going to go into all the details of how this played out. I'm just basing it on what I read in the Chronicle of Higher Education. But this reality that he was instructed, required not to teach certain passages from Plato's works, and in particular from Plato's Symposium. And because of that, by the way, took his stand and left the school and went to a private institution. Now he's teaching at SMU, as I understand it. This is Martin Peterson is the professor's name. Not a politically motivated activist. He's none of that kind of stuff. He's just a philosophy professor that taught from a book that the state of Texas decided should not be included in material that students could be exposed to because it was too touchy, too close to issues that felt like they were promoting the LGBTQ plus agenda or something like that. So I say all of that, and it's automatic to me. I'm like, you got to be joking. We're censoring books in a philosophy class at a university level at a school like Texas A&M? What on earth? Who would think that's smart? That's my immediate response, right? Other people's response to it is, well, what on earth was in the book that they wanted to keep it out? Maybe it's really dumb, you know, and it needs to be kept out. Now, I will say, even if it's really dumb, why would you keep it out? If it's just dumb, what's the point of keeping it out? You go, you expose the material, and then you talk to the students, and then you figure out a better place to land, right? So I'll read it to you. I'm going to read you the section that he was required not to teach at Texas A&M, best I understand it. And I understand it fairly well. So this one is from Plato's Symposium, and it is a quotation from, it's a section of the book that is supposed to be spoken by Aristophanes. He's the character in the book who's speaking it. Most of Plato's works are written in dialogues, and it's between Socrates and somebody else. And anyway, Aristophanes says these things, and this is sort of a myth, an origin myth about the sexes for humanity. And the idea that someone would read this and go, huh, I guess I do agree with, you know, some position that the state of Texas doesn't like, is just to me kind of silly. I mean, it's kind of absurd. Why would you censor a book like this? So here's the quotation from Aristophanes. The sexes were originally three. And this is a myth of the origins of the human race, right? So the sexes were originally three, men, women, and the union of the two. And they were made round, having four hands, four feet, two faces on a round neck, and the rest to correspond. Terrible was their strength and swiftness, and they were essaying to scale heaven and attack the gods. Doubt reigned in the celestial councils. The gods were divided between the desire of quelling the pride of man and the fear of losing the sacrifices. At last, Zeus hit upon an expedient. Let us cut them in two, he said. Then they will only have half their strength, and we shall have twice as many sacrifices. So he spake and split them as you might split an egg with a hair, which I have not done, but now I'm tempted to do, by the way. And when this was done, he told Apollo to give their faces a twist and rearrange their persons, taking out the wrinkles and tying the skin in a knot about their navel. The two halves went about looking for one another, and they were ready to die of hunger in one another's arms. Then Zeus invented an adjustment of the sexes, which enabled them to marry and go their way to the business of life. That, oh, you can see, oh, man, we don't want our students having to read that. Can you believe this is censored from being read in a Texas A&M philosophy class? Now, I'm not trying to assault Texas A&M. It's a fine school. I mean, it's a juggernaut of a school. I'm not criticizing them. I'm looking and saying, what on earth are we doing to intellectual freedom in a classroom when we're not willing to have a passage like that read? What kind of fear are we living in? What kind of inferiority do we think our ideas have that they can't stand up to that. A myth about Zeus cutting four-armed and, you know, two-faced creatures in half and creating the sexes. Give me a break. Okay, that's extreme enough. Okay. Anyway, independents in the boardroom facing the same kind of trouble, assault from the culture in general, but especially from legislators and especially in the public sector. But it's true in the private sector as well. It happens some. And the idea in the boardroom, and I'm not going to try to hash out why this is so important, but it is so important, is that you want to eliminate conflicts of interest. You have to demonstrate that a trustee for a college has the best interest of that college or university in mind. There can't be any divided loyalty. And what's happening now, and this has happened throughout history, unfortunately, it's always bad, is that states, either governors or legislators or whoever's in charge of it in the given state, are packing boards based on political agendas, not based on what's going to be best for the university, not on preserving the mission or the interest of the university, but on promoting their political agenda. That is a divided loyalty. That creates what amounts to a conflict of interest, not financial or legal, but a divided loyalty. And it's a sufficiently severe problem right now to have prompted the resignation of prominent university presidents, either leaving education altogether to go into some other sector because it's just not worth the fight, or moving into the private sector from the public sector, again, looking for a board that doesn't have divided loyalties. So those pillars, I'm just saying, those kinds of actions that are going on against those fundamental values in higher education right now sort of illustrate how bad things have gotten in this current moment. And it's not just in the public sector. It's also in the private sector and in the one that I'm particularly attached to, I'm right in the middle of, which is Christian higher education. And I don't just mean tangentially, denominationally attached institutions. When I'm saying it, I mean Christian higher education in the sense of those schools that have a commitment to Christ, keeping him prominent in what we're doing, and our commitment in my type of school to Scripture and the things that we understand about Christian doctrine being central to our mission. Well, this cynicism extends also to those schools. And again, that's not new. I'm just going to talk about Baptists for a minute because that's what I've been my whole life. And so I always deal with this denomination. And Baptists, a lot like many other Christian traditions, have sort of a love-hate relationship with education. We definitely say we love it. Baptists say we love education. We have a whole article in our, it's called the Baptist Faith and Message, in our what should be just a declaration of our faith, what has become a creed, unfortunately, not just a confession, but whatever. The Baptist Faith and Message, Article 12, is about higher education. It's about education in general. Christianity is the faith of enlightenment and intelligence. This is that article. In Jesus Christ abide all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. All sound learning is, therefore, a part of our Christian heritage. The new birth opens up all human faculties and creates a thirst for knowledge. It's kind of an enlightenment tinged statement, by the way, but whatever. It's a statement endorsing higher education. Moreover, the cause of education in the kingdom of Christ is coordinate with the causes of missions and general benevolence, and should receive, along with these liberal support of the churches. An adequate system of Christian education is necessary to a complete spiritual program for Christ's people. In Christian education, there should be a proper balance between academic freedom and academic responsibility. Freedom in any orderly relationship of human life is always limited and never absolute. Did you hear the shift? The first of it is all, oh, we have a new mind, we're open to knowledge, we want to learn and we want to grow. The last half of what I'm reading to you is all saying, however, let's keep it in check because we know it can get out of hand, right? So in Christian education, there should be a proper balance between academic freedom and academic responsibility. They don't just mean academic, but That's what they said. Academic responsibility, freedom, and these are true statements, obviously. Freedom in any orderly relationship of human life is always limited, never absolute. The freedom of a teacher in a Christian school, college, or seminary, I'm still reading from the BFNM, Article 12, is limited by the preeminence of Jesus Christ, by the authoritative nature of the scriptures, and by the distinct purpose for which the school exists. It's funny, isn't it? There is this, oh, we love Christian higher education, but we also have these little cautionary lines. You know, in Christian education, there should be a proper balance between academic freedom and responsibility. Again, they say academic responsibility, but that's not what they mean. They don't just mean submitting to the academy. They mean submitting to the authorities who are over you in that academic setting. Anyway, in addition to that, freedom in any orderly relationship of human life is always limited and never absolute. Don't go demanding total intellectual freedom. We're not going to give you that. We don't trust you with that. And then this is the reality. This is what they say. The freedom of a teacher in a Christian school, college, or seminary is limited by three things. We're not happy enough to say, you know, they have to comport with the mission statement of the school, or they have to comport with the doctrinal statement of the school. They're not satisfied with that. It's got to be by, they're limited by the preeminence of Jesus Christ. I mean, are you submitted to him? Well, of course we want to be. By the authoritative natures of scripture, which, by the way, at Criswell College, we're absolutely committed to. You have to do that in order to be a professor here. And by the distinct purpose for which the school exists, which, of course, again, at Criswell College, I absolutely agree with, and we do. What I find funny is that we can't say we love higher education without putting the parenthesis, putting the bracket around it that says, but it's always a threat. You know, it's a, there's always this risk that goes with higher education. I get that. But I will say, with all of my experience in Baptist life and then all of my experience with Christian higher education, I know that what we really love as Baptists in higher education are the credentials. We're okay with the fact that a student might learn something, but that's not what's really important. What we really need is for them to get the credentials, you know. And part of that means that they've gained the self-discipline of going through a four-year program and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, don't bring the mumbo-jumbo back from your sophisticated books to our church. You know, we've got it all under order right now. So you can hear the sort of cynicism in my own mind that's in me regarding the tenuous and sometimes stressful relationship between Christianity and, in particular, my denomination, Baptists, and higher education. It's just part of what's built into it. It's just there. But there is a tradition tying Christian leadership to higher education. And, you know, the easiest sort of low-hanging fruit or best example of that in American history is just Jonathan Edwards. It's a perfect example. Here's the man who leads the Great Awakening, you know. He's the preacher, theologian, philosopher of the Great Awakening, and then becomes the president of Princeton University, which at the time was the College of New Jersey. You know, that's what it was called. And admittedly, he wasn't there for all that long, but that's the whole point. He was already a philosopher, already a theologian, already one of the deepest thinkers in America, maybe the greatest mind the American continent ever produced, and he's a preacher. There's a relationship between what we recognize as Christian leadership and education, and that I appreciate and I respect about Christian history and heritage. And historically, normally, and I don't know how many different times I heard this in all of my education, when I was in college or in graduate school, and how many different examples people gave of this, but Jonathan Edwards is a good one. Historically and normally, and I mean historically, let's say 100 years ago or 500 years ago, you know, this is just the way it was in the transatlantic world, in America, in Europe, you know. Historically and normally, the clergy member in a town, whoever the parson was or the preacher or whatever, the priest, whoever it was, the clergy member in a town was the best educated person in that town. It's just, and there are a lot of different reasons for that, I know, but that link, that relationship isn't something that we ought to ignore. And of course, by the way, all of the stigma and prestige that goes with being clergy also went with being educated. You know, because you can, you can imagine all the different caricatures of the clergy. Oh, well, his head is in the clouds. You know, he's a little too disconnected from the daily pressures of mundane life to do us any good. He's that person that's just not connected with the rest of us. But at the same time, he's also someone who can be trusted to bring a bigger or richer or deeper or maybe just outside perspective to problems that in the mundane course of life might seem insurmountable. There's also, by the way, the constant tension with the clergy of being hypocritical because they're supposed to live up to a higher moral standard and sometimes they don't live up to that standard. And it's the same way with education. Well, you're supposed to be smarter. He's book smart, but he can't even tie his own shoes. That kind of parallel between the ways we think about the clergy and the ways we think about education sort of feed into the kind of cynicism that I'm talking about coming to a head right now in our society again. And so what I want to do in response to that, the fact that everywhere you turn right now, and you may not pay as much attention to it as I do. Again, obviously, I'm right in the middle of the higher education industry. So I get why I notice every one of these stories when they pop up. But it is remarkable. The change right now is remarkable. The pressure against higher education is profound in this moment. And in that context, I don't just want to lament it. Oh, it's so sad. Woe is me. What are we going to do? But I want to respond to it and in one way to say, Let me establish for us again, or at least remind us again, of the underlying value in education. I know prima facie, we all think, oh, well, it's good to just have knowledge and get access to the truth, and that's an inherent good. And we all sort of have in the back of our minds, and it's a good way to make more money, which means it's a good way to give the economy the workforce that it needs, which is what I hear all the time. We talked about those two things in the previous episode. Those are just prima facie. What I want to get at is the value that underlies higher education that goes beyond that, that's even better. And so I want to start by saying that I'm intrinsically, my nature is automatically going to go toward the liberal arts model value of higher education. That's where I think the core of the value lies. That's why I brought up Alan Bloom's book to begin with. I didn't learn it from Alan Bloom. I didn't read it from him when I was going through my liberal arts education at Baylor. But you know what he says reinforces what I was talking about, and I think there's a fundamental value to that that we should not ignore. And I suspect it's going to take me more than just this one episode to get to that point, but we're going to start driving towards it right now. And so part of getting at the underlying value in education is to recognize how the contrast, and also they are complementary to each other, the idea of the economic contribution and the liberal arts model in higher education. So one of the things I think worth keeping in mind, I'll say it this way, is that higher education's most important place in history and in society in general is easy to forget because of the success higher education has meeting the needs of a specific moment. So let me put it just in terms of history in the given moment. We can, because higher ed is having success in a given moment, ooh, look at the quality people they're putting into the computer industry or into the AI industry right now. Well, look at how well this is being done. Look at the graduates they're putting into nursing or into elementary education or whatever it is. And wow, what a great job they did with the medical industry right now. We can see all of that and lose entirely the importance of the liberal arts side of the education that's been provided throughout history, that has shaped our whole culture to become something that needs the medical industry that we have, that becomes something that could have the kind of transportation infrastructure that we have. Higher education's most important place in that history can be forgotten because of the success that it's had meeting the needs of the moment right now. The academy's ability to train a workforce, in other words, can obscure the contribution that it could make to a society that relies on that workforce. So to give an example of what I mean, or to illustrate what I mean, let me just use two pieces of literature. One that some people might not recognize, but the other I think everyone will recognize. One, C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength. Think about the barren emptiness of the society that's created there, the sterility of that landscape, you know, replacing organic real trees with pieces of steel, you know, stuff like that. You're creating a world that's devoid of the beauty that comes from the organic nature of reality. And that's a metaphor for more than just biology and bacteria and diseases. It's not just that. It's a metaphor for all the beauty that comes from the arts and literature and the influence of romanticism and all of the messy nature of human interactions and all that kind of stuff. That's what's being lost. And it's the same description that comes in the other work, which is Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. In Huxley's Brave New World, the same kind of stripping humanity of the richness of the organic ugliness, you know, of human life and interaction is part of the joke in the book. And it is, I know some people, you could read it as a very serious book. It's a satire, you know, it's a satirical book. It's a funny book. But it's based on that contrast. And the idea of what the liberal arts brings is that kind of stuff. We want people with deeper psychological and spiritual roots than are required for merely functioning in a very sophisticated economic engine. You can do that. You can function in a very sophisticated economic engine and be completely devoid of the meaning of life, completely lose any of the richness that comes from what a better education can provide you. And that's what I mean by the richness of that liberal arts model. When I was at school at UTA and when I was at school at Baylor, in both contexts, the other school I was at was this one, Criswell College. That's where our studio is. It's on the campus of Criswell College. And I served there. I've mentioned several times. I'm an administrator here. When here, we don't have a quadrangle. You know, we're a very small school, and we don't have a divided campus. And all of our students, I mean, we only have one degree that's a BS, a Bachelor of Science, instead of a BA, a Bachelor of Arts. And that's because the BS in education has so many hours of requirement for our elementary ed students, for the students who are going in that direction, that there's not room to make it into a Bachelor of Arts. But they still get, even our BS in education students, they still get a Bachelor of Arts in Bible and Theology. They still get a major in Bible and Theology. So we're a liberal arts school. You know, that's our model. And so it's not the same here. But at the other two schools I attended, for my bachelor's degree at Baylor, for my PhD at UTA, there was something of a way of talking about a quadrangle, that there were two different sides to the campus. The Bachelor of Science type of side, the engineering and science and technology side to the university, and then the arts side, where you were doing literature and fine arts and things like that. And so when I talk about the two sides of the quadrangle, that's what I have in mind. That's what I'm talking about. And so when you think about the two sides of the quadrangle, if there's a debate between the value that's brought by those two sides, I admit readily that what I propose is that the emphasis ought to be placed on the liberal arts side. The science and engineering and professional side of training, it only really achieves the higher ed status that it ought to have when it's tied to, I'm not saying it can be separated from the pure science and technology and the practice of the discipline kind of stuff that goes with the science. I'm not saying that. But it can only really become a product of higher education when it is also tied into the broader liberal arts style exposure that comes from gen ed requirements, for example, requirements in literature or language or all the other disciplines. Because it exposes you to all those other ideas that, instead of an architect just producing a functional building, allows them to produce something with beauty that has a fine arts influence or whatever it is. And when you lose that, you lose a lot in a culture or society, as I was given the indication of in That Hideous Strength or in Brave New World. But it's, you know, and by the way, it's not just in the classroom, it's not just the curriculum, it's also the benefit of having a campus where science students And by the way, this goes vice versa also, but where science students have to mingle with literature students, where mathematicians have to interact with musicians or linguists. There is a richness in that kind of education that benefits the whole of society when people go out and start doing their jobs. And I do mean by that, that art students also need to interact with science students and so on. There's an intellectual maturity that's provided by higher education that's hard to come by otherwise. And it goes beyond just the breadth of it and the interaction with other people. So let me give the contrast of self-education. And there are lots of people who are self-educated who are brilliant, who are fantastic at what they do. And yet, even in the smartest, there's always a loss of not having been able to participate in higher education. I'm not saying, everyone who went through higher ed is better than someone who was self-educated. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there is a benefit to higher education that's worth mentioning, because self-education, even for the very brightest among us, is inevitably accomplished in at least partially an echo chamber of confirmation bias. How could it not be? It's your own mind that's confirming that the stuff you're reading is either valuable or not valuable. So you can learn to think increasingly deeply and with better support, even by educating yourself, even by just reading the books you pick and doing the best you can with all the information that you have in your own mind. You can learn to think increasingly deeply and with better support. But you can't be corrected by material that never crosses into the horizon of your own perspective. You won't be nudged and adjusted by the people who are outside the sphere of your thinking, which we all need. And what the liberal arts model does, including in that direction, in two parts, this is demonstrable, measurable. It's fairly obvious when you read material from individuals who go in either direction. The liberal arts model does, number one, it exposes you to disciplines that you would have preferred to ignore. I've not been exposed to every discipline by any stretch of the imagination, but I've been exposed to almost all of them, and I've had formal courses in almost everything. The only exception to that is not since eighth grade, when it was combined with other physical sciences. I've not had a college level, higher education level course in chemistry. Never have. I'm embarrassed about that now, and I've read books on chemistry so that I could understand more about chemistry. I don't mean that I picked up a chemistry textbook. I mean I've read books that were pretty steeped in science of chemistry because they're fascinating. They're interesting when you read about them more in a historical context. I still don't know enough about chemistry to have an intelligent conversation with a freshman student in chemistry right now. I couldn't do it, and that's embarrassing to me. But I've got all the others, so I'm okay. I'm not criticizing myself over it, but I am saying the only reason I have the others is because somebody made me do it. And I'll give another example of that in just a minute. Somebody made me do it. They made me take a class in psychology, or they made me take a class in whatever it was. And secondly, by the way, so it exposes you to a range of disciplines that you just might not even be interested in otherwise, and we learn things from other disciplines. We learn things when we're exposed to ways of thinking that we weren't interested in to begin with. Otherwise, again, we're just confirming our own thoughts about ourselves. So the second area is that it helps with, and this is within any subject matter, it presses you into the spaces within that subject matter that you would have avoided. Oh, I don't like talking about that. Well, you got to read it because you're going to have to discuss it in class tomorrow. You have to write a paper about it, or there's a pop quiz about it, or whatever it is when you're in a more formal setting. And that includes, by the way, just being precise with vocabulary when you're writing or discussing issues that matter. And I'll give an example of this in terms of what I get to do. As a professor, I also teach right now, and I've taught at secular schools, and I've taught at Christian schools, so I've been in different contexts, and this is pretty much what you're always doing when you're dealing with undergrads. When I'm working with, and I work with some really brilliant undergrad students, they're way smarter than I am, and I'm not making that up, they're smarter than I am, they read better than I do, they're doing, the only advantage I have over them is decades of experience and the time to have read a lot more stuff than they've read. So I've got some advantages, but not intellectual advantages over them. So here they are, brilliant undergrad students. A significant part of what I do with them is simply help them take their already rich ideas and put them in a vocabulary so that people who already have positions of influence, for instance, will respect their input and maybe even open doors for them. Hey, I like that idea, I will say, but what you're talking about is this. This is the subject matter, and this is how you describe that so that somebody else who's listening to you will know what you're talking about and then can run with your idea, and they jump on it. Oh, I've got the words for it. It's sort of inviting them into the magic language, you know, of whatever. And so I love being able to do that. That's one of the things you gain when you're in a formal educational environment, when you're gaining from education, just a way of, it's not just abbreviating your conversation, but it does help in that way too, of knowing that this conversation has been had for hundreds of years and you don't have to rehash all of that. If you'll just use this word, everybody will know what you're talking about, and then you can just run forward with the idea that you've got and people can go with you. But it's also discovering a passion. I remember when I took a course here in ethics. I think it was just Introduction to Ethics. But my professor was Doug Blunt. He's somebody whose name you may have encountered in another place. Really brilliant professor. Always been a fantastic human being. I really like the guy. Anyway, I took him. I didn't know him from Adam at the time. He was just the professor in the class. I think he's younger than I am, but he was already a professor while I was still working on my MDiv here at Criswell College. And so I'm taking my MDiv, he's teaching Intro to Ethics, and I sit in the classroom and I listen to this brilliant person talk about topics I have always wondered about. I have dreamed about these topics. I've hashed them out in my head and been sort of ashamed that I was thinking those thoughts because they were so esoteric in my mind that nobody else would have been interested in them. And he starts talking about them and showing how practically important they are, and I'm like, this is where people talk about the stuff that I love. I never even knew this discipline existed. I can't wait. And it became the focus of not just finishing my MDiv, but going on into my PhD studies. My encounter, that transformed my life. The opportunity to do that came because I had to take a course I never even would have signed up for. I would not even have read a book about it if someone hadn't had it in the program of my education. So I'm, by the way, super thankful for that and thankful to you, Doug Blunt, for the influence you had on my life. Grateful to you. So, you know, there's a lot to lose if we reduce higher education to nothing but some kind of return on our investment. I'll say this, and then I'll end for this part of the conversation, and then we'll have one more part that I want to have to bring it back, not just to higher education in general, but to Christian higher education, and not just Christian higher education in general, but specifically the kind of ministry-oriented education that we do at Criswell College. And it's not an ad for the college. There are other schools who do this too. I'm happy to do ads for the college. I love our school. Come to our school. This is the place you ought to be, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the point here. The point here is to say we need this kind of education. That's what I want to get back to in the next episode. Let me conclude this episode with this point. The kind of reduction that would say higher education is only valuable if the amount of money you invested into it, either through your student loans or by paying cash for it or adding together what you're going to pay plus what the state pays into it or what donors have paid into it, whichever way, if you is only worth it if you're going to make more money income-wise than you would have made if you had not gone to school. A return on investment kind of scorecard. That kind of reduction robs society. And I'm not even talking about Christian ministry education yet. This is just in general. That kind of reduction robs society of the greater benefits higher ed can bring to it. And not only the kind of, and this is part of it, higher ed can bring this innovation, which could break a paradigm, which could change an industry. So even on the economic side, there's more to it than just an individual making more money or an industry being able to provide its workforce. There's also the ability to do the kind of research that could break a paradigm. That could, and so, but beyond that, It can also influence the cultural memory. It can inculcate cultural memory and purpose that can ground and give meaningful direction to everything else. Understanding, as an example, why America's history arrived at the Civil War, or why Russia's history arrived at the end of serfdom, that changes the significance of practical conversations about what's going on in the real world right now, current social, economic, and political changes that are happening right now. But we don't know enough of our history. We don't spend enough time being honest in all of that historical literature to have those meaningful conversations now. We have shallowed out the pool within which we can have that conversation if we reduce the value of higher ed to nothing but a return on your investment in the economy. The academy may not be the academy by I mean the whole higher education infrastructure, right? The academy may not be the only place where that kind of influence can arise, but it is arguably the best. And I mean that both because of the actual experiences we have and also because of the nature of the higher ed industry. Among other reasons is this: when young people are turning into adults, college gives them the time and the place to retreat from the social structure's rapids of daily obligation. You know, get up and go to your job and go back and learn a little more and then do your job a little bit better. It allows them to back up from that and then to stare into the long history of ideas that have brought us to the present moment, and for them to consider intentionally what the best course forward is, not just because they're caught up in the flow of daily obligations. Higher education faces, and this is fair, due criticism when it becomes just 4 years to avoid impending adulthood. And that happens a lot. People give themselves over to the partying atmosphere, or to, I'm just going to refuse to grow up, and they continue to be children. I agree. That deserves criticism. That's fine. But those 4 years of retreat can instead become an opportunity for students who are less restricted by the urgency of that workaday obligation to become explorers who are creative in approaching those eddies that have long proven their worth in societies that have the wherewithal to allow them. In other words, if we can give 4 years of serious opportunity for study and learning and integrating to a student's mind, we can produce students who actually can influence our society in a better way, not just feed into what society already is. We can do that. And we can do more than that. When we put this in the Christian perspective, I want to talk about how it becomes even more than that. That will be in the next episode.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill, as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.